The year's theme, the overarching theme for the year, is heroes of the Dharma. And many of our heroes of the Dharma, the true Ratna's heroes, are on the refuge tree, which is on the shrine here, male and female. And it does illustrate the ecumenical nature of our movement, which is why I did the handout there. So it gives you a bit of a flavour of the various influences for, in particular, Bhante Sangharajita, the founder of our movement. And if you wanted to know more, then on the theme of bookshops, this book I just borrowed from a bookshop to show you, and it's a superb book, Teachers of Enlightenment, which basically covers the various figures on the refuge tree, the True Ratna refuge tree. Very nice little introduction to each of the figures, and enables you to get just a bit of a connection with each of the various different figures. So it's a very nice book. Anyway, in the middle of the refuge tree, as you can see, is the Buddha Shakyamuni, and it's there that our story begins. And so I'm going to talk about the Buddha's life this evening, the next half hour or so. So feel free to get comfy. And you may well have heard some stories about the Buddha. You may be very familiar with the life of the Buddha. And of course, there were no fly-on-the-wall documentaries or mobile phones with cameras and that sort of thing back in those days, obviously. So we don't have any footage of the actual Buddha. And so it's difficult to know how much of what we've come to understand about the Buddha is historical truth and how much is mythologized. And in a sense, in a way, it doesn't really matter as long as it inspires us and helps us in our Buddhist practice. So I'm not going to necessarily dissect things in that way over the course of the next half hour. So I'm just going to tell you something of a story. So let's begin our story by going back 2,500 years ago not to the dusty plains of northern India, where most of our story would take place, but instead to the foothills of the Himalayas, a little to the north, along what we now think of as the border between India and Nepal, the lush sort of green foothills there. And 2,500 years ago, we would have found the tribe of the Shakyas. So they were a relatively small group of people. They had the territory that they'd carved out for themselves, and around them were a number of other similar tribes, relatively small tribes, all jostling for position. And there were two big kingdoms as well, Kosala and Magadha. And so these, the smaller kingdoms, like the kingdom of the territory of the Shakyas, were somewhat in the shadow of these bigger kingdoms. Like all small territories, I suppose, when you've got a big neighbour, it could be a bit threatening at times. So they had their insecurities, the Shakyas. And one of the leaders of the Shakya people was a man known as Suddhodana. In some stories, he's said to be the king, but in other stories, we've come to understand that he was one of the leaders of the tribe, one of the elders, or whatever they might be called. Anyway, he was an important person amongst the Shakyas, and he and his wife, Maya, were expecting their first child. So a big moment for them, obviously. And as was traditional in those days, Maya, when her birth was drawing near, she made her way back to her ancestral family home. She didn't make it all the way back to her ancestral family home, given the unpredictable nature of these things, I suppose. And so she ended up giving birth in Lumbini Gardens, which you can still go and visit now if you wish. And she gave birth to a boy that was named Siddhartha Gautama. Unfortunately, within a few days of the birth, Maya died. And so the young boy was brought up by his auntie, Mahaprajapati. Now, of course, the father, Siddhartha, was delighted that he had a son, an heir, to follow on in his footsteps. And so what he thought he'd do, he wanted to know what lay in store for the young young boy. So we got in the one of the local wise men to foretell the future of the young boy. And so the wise man came in and he consulted the signs and communed with whatever gods it was that he communed with and so on and so forth. And after a period of time, he came up with the future, that he was able to tell what would happen to this young boy. And so he told Suddhodana, well, great things are in store for this young boy. He will either be a great secular leader, a great leader, much like yourself, and he will be a great leader of people. Or, on the other hand, he will be a great spiritual leader, a revolutionary spiritual leader. So Suddhodana, his father, was quite clear on what he wanted from the young boy. He didn't want any of the spiritual nonsense. So he wanted the boy to grow up like he did, to be a leader of the people, a great leader of the people. And perhaps this great leader could secure their boundaries. The Shakya people needed great leaders. Perhaps even he could turn them into one of these big kingdoms as well. So they didn't have to worry so much and be so insecure about these big neighbours. So that's what Suddhodana wanted very much. And he thought that people tend to turn to spiritual matters when they reflect on the shortcomings of the world, the unsatisfactory nature of it all, and the pain and the suffering and the old age and the death and all that sort of stuff. So he figured that if he could keep his young boy away from these sorts of things as much as possible, give him all the nice things in life, make sure all his sensual pleasures were met, then maybe his mind wouldn't turn towards the spiritual side of things. So that's what he tried to do. So as a young boy grew up, he tried to ensure that all his wants and needs were met, and he tried to keep him away from sickness and old age and death and so on. And he ensured that he was instructed in all the things that he would need to know if he was going to be a secular leader. So he learned all the martial arts, like archery and javelin throwing and charioteering and so on. And he learned all the things that he needed to know to run a kingdom. You know, he learned how to administer a kingdom. He learned how to dispense justice and these sorts of things. So as he grew up, he was being groomed to be this new great leader for the Shakyas. And he grew up in the capital of Astu, of the Shakyas territory, and he was kept to the royal palaces. Probably not palaces in the way that we think of them these days, but nevertheless, he was in a relative luxury for the time, and all his needs were met. And in his late teens, he took a wife, and together they had their own son. So in many ways he had what you might think was a perfect life. He had all his needs, he had security, he had his future mapped out for him. He really had everything that he needed. Had a nice family, all these sorts of things. And yet, as he grew older, he had a growing sense of dis-ease. Now his father, Suddhodana, was aware of this, and so he tried to step up even more the protection that he placed Siddhartha Gautama under. But Siddhartha Gautama really wanted to see some more of the wider world. He realised that he was being in a bubble, as it were, here, and he wasn't really seeing the true picture. So he asked his father if he could go out and see something of the city, something of the surroundings. And he may well have argued that this was important for his education. How could he expect to lead people if he didn't know anything about their lives? How could he fight battles if he'd never been outside of a palace? So he managed to convince his father that, yeah, okay, it would be a good idea for him to go out and see something of the wider world. And so that's what he did. Now, meanwhile, his father tried to usher away anything that might be a little bit unpleasant away from the sight of Siddhartha Gautama. So any people that were a bit older, a bit unhealthy looking, were sort of kept indoors, and the city was spruced up to look as nice as possible. And so Siddhartha Gautama went out with his charioteer out into the city for his tour. And it was at this point that he came to see what's become known as the four sights. So the first thing that he saw was a sick person, somebody who was obviously sick and suffering. And Siddhartha Gautama was somewhat taken aback by this. It's hard to believe that he's never actually seen a sick person before, but perhaps this signifies that this was the first time that it really came home to him. This was the lot of the human being. Anyway, he turned to his charioteer and said, what's going on with this person? What's wrong with them? And the charioteer said that, this person's unwell. They're ill. They're sick. And, that's what befalls all people, all human beings at some stage. So, a bit unsettled by this, they carried on. And they came to the next site, which was an old person, somebody bent over and struggling to amble along, perhaps with a stick. And again, Siddhartha Gautama, shocked by this sight, and asked the charioteer, what's going on here now? What's with this person? And the charioteer explained, this is an old person. This is a person who's lived all their lives. And as they're approaching, as they're getting older and older, their body stops working so well. And they're in pain, and that's what we see here. This is the fate of all of us if we live long enough. So on they went, and they came to the third site, which was a corpse in a funeral procession. And again, Siddhartha Gautama, what's happening here? He asked his charioteer, and his charioteer said, this is that there is a dead person. This is what happens when your life ends. This is the fate of all of us. We will all die, we will all have our own funeral at some stage. And again, so the Siddhartha Gautama was shocked to hear this. It perhaps had never occurred to him, the reality of this, that this would be something that he too would face. So then they came to a fourth site, which was a local wandering spiritual man, a sadhu, of which there were very many in India at that time, and of which there are quite a number in India still to this day. And there seemed to be something in particular about this individual, because he caught Siddhartha Gautama's eye, and maybe he had some charisma, or maybe he seemed unburdened or contented in a way that other people were not, because again, he asked the charioteer who this was, and the charioteer explained that this is a wandering man. He's given up all his family and his possessions. All he has is what he's standing in, basically, or carrying. And yet he has this contentment. So all this very much planted a seed in Siddhartha Gautama's mind. And he realized that he felt he had no choice but to go and find the answers to the questions that were arising in his mind. He needed to find solutions to the problems such as sickness, old age, and death. He couldn't just go on with his normal life knowing that this was all in store for him and all in store for everybody else. In fact, he couldn't understand how anybody could just go on with their normal lives knowing that this was in store. He knew his father wouldn't let him do anything of that kind, so he only had one option, which was to leave. So he fled the palace, he cut his hair short, he gave away his fine clothes and just started wearing rags, and began his own life as a wandering seeker after spiritual answers. So the first thing he did, he decided to go and try and get some instruction. So he went to a meditation teacher by the name of Alara Kalama, and he was with him for a few months, and he learnt the techniques that Kalama taught him, and he mastered these techniques, and Kalama felt that Siddhartha had become his equal, and so offered to share his small group of followers with him, to be joint leaders of their group. But Siddhartha Gautama, although he had attained these states of meditation and they were very pleasurable to sit like that in a blissful state, he realised that it wasn't the answer that he was seeking. It meant that he could just bliss out, I suppose, for a period of time, but it wasn't the solution. So he moved on. And he found another teacher, Udaka Ramaputra, who taught further meditation teachings. Again, same story, Siddhartha Gautama, after a period of time, mastered these teachings, was acknowledged as becoming equal with his teacher, but again realized that it wasn't the solution, and so moved on. He decided next to try practices of asceticism, very popular in India. Still to this day, people try ascetic practices of various sorts. So, for example, some people endure the five-sun practice, which is you sit in the midst of four fires, blazing fires, one in front of you, one to the side, two to the side, and one behind. And then the fifth fire is the sun beating down on you. And so it's quite warm. And so some people do that. Other people do things like holding your arm up in the air for indefinitely, for years and years and years, until it just atrophies. And people still do these sorts of things today in India. And the idea being that by overcoming the physical, that you can break away and break away from the restrictions and the limitations of the physical body. So that's what Siddhartha Gautama tried. His chosen practice was to starve himself, which was quite popular in those days. So he went to particular lengths with his practice over a period of 6 years, and he was acknowledged as being something of a master of the practice, and he became naturally very, very thin and emaciated. He had his own small following of five individuals, and together they spent their time just meditating, presumably discussing spiritual matters, and not eating very much. So this went on for 6 years. And then on one occasion, Siddhartha Gautama happened to overhear a couple of people chatting, and they were chatting about a musical instrument. One of the people was the teacher, and one was the pupil. And so the teacher was saying, explaining to the pupil how for this stringed instrument, you have to tune the strings just right to make it sound nice. If you tune them too tight, then they might break, as well as not sounding quite right. And if you tune them too loose, then they would vibrate against the body of the instrument, and again, they wouldn't sound correct. So you had to tune it just right, in the middle way, you might say. And this immediately struck a chord with Siddhartha Gautama, who realized that he'd been doing the opposite of that. He'd been practicing extremes over these last few years. In the first few decades of his life, he had the extremes of luxury, of indulgence, of plenty, of sensual pleasure. And that hadn't made him happy. So then he went to the other extreme of denying what his body needed and what he wanted, and to try to use that to overcome, to make a breakthrough with his practice of starvation. And after 6 years, that had reached a dead end too. So he realized that perhaps a correct approach was the middle way between those two extremes. So at that time he decided that he would break his fast. Now his five followers were disgusted at this time because they thought he just sold out and that he'd just given up really. And so they left him. So here he was then, finally, after all these years of strife and practice and effort, alone, and still without an answer to the problem. And at this time, a local woman turned up, and Sujita, her name was. And it so happened that she'd been trying for a child for a number of years and without success. And she was told that if she made offerings to the local forest god, that she would be blessed with a child. So she made offerings to the local forest god, and sure enough, she had a child. And after she'd given birth to the child, she thought, well, she'd better go back and make another offering to the forest god just to show her gratitude. And so that's what she did. So she turned up with this really nice dish of milk rice. And it's quite a story about how she made it, actually, but I haven't really got time to go into that now, but it's quite nice. And if you go to Bodh Gaya today You can go into one of the cafes there and have Sujata rice, just like Siddhartha Gautama had. So anyway, she turns up, goes into the forest, and she sees Siddhartha Gautama sitting there, and she thinks, crikey, it really is the forest god. There he is, all sitting there, straggly hair, emaciated, just like you might imagine a forest god would look like. And so she said, oh, I'm so pleased to see you, thank you very much, and here I've brought you this offering. And of course Siddhartha Gautama explained what was really going on and who he really was. But he accepted the offering and began to regain his strength as Sujata tended to feed him up. So he regained his strength, which gave him the strength he needed to take the next steps of his practice, of his journey. So when he felt strong enough, he decided he would simply sit down under this particular tree and he would not get up again until he found the answers that he'd sought, how to overcome the sufferings of existence. He would either do it there and then, or he would die in the attempt. And one evening, he was getting very close. So close that Mara, who is the personification of evil, or perhaps you could think of it as the last vestiges of the hindrances within the mind of Siddhartha Gautama. But whichever way you look at it, Mara arrived. Now he was very unhappy about this because Siddhartha Gautama was getting close to finding the answer, and Mara didn't want people to find the answer. He preferred the suffering aspect of things. So he wanted to try and stop Siddhartha Gautama. So the first thing he did was he called forth his armies, and they launched their arrows at Siddhartha Gautama. So Siddhartha Gautama was sitting under the tree, and towards him came hurtling hundreds of arrows. But in his mind's eye, he simply turned them all into petals of flowers, and they fluttered down and landed at his feet. So the next thing Mara did was he thought, I know, I'll tempt Siddhartha Gautama. So he brought forth his beautiful daughters, scantily clad, to try and tempt Siddhartha Gautama. But at their appearance, Siddhartha Gautama, in his mind's eye, simply imagined them as they grew older and older, as we all do, and could see their real nature, flesh and blood, like the rest of us, with all our own failings and shortcomings and so on. And so they lost their attraction. Mara now was getting a bit desperate, so he thought he would appeal to Siddhartha Gautama's vanity, and he said, who on earth do you think you are that you believe you can sit there as if you're going to find the answer, as if you're going to get enlightened, after people have been searching for this for thousands of years? Who do you think you are? And Siddhartha Gautama simply touched the ground with the fingers of one hand, and arising from the ground came the earth goddess. And the earth goddess testified that she had witnessed Siddhartha Gautama, the being who would be Siddhartha Gautama, practicing over many, many, many lifetimes, over hundreds and thousands of years. And he had indeed, if anybody had, earned the right to sit there at that spot on the verge of getting enlightenment. And so with that, Mara was banished. And as the evening wore on, Siddhartha Gautama did indeed manage to make that breakthrough. So he saw the true nature of cause and effect. He was able to see the way that suffering affects us all, and he was able to be freed from the eight worldly winds that normally blow us around. He had liberated himself. So what to do next? He spent a few weeks around the environs of that particular tree, the Bodhi tree, assimilating his experience and reflecting and meditating and deciding what he was going to do next. Initially, he thought that it would be impossible to try and pass on what he'd learned, because it was what he'd attained, what he'd seen, what he'd experienced, because it was beyond words. So how could he explain it? And he tried to think of ways that he could maybe help people along the path himself, but he was doubtful. And at this time he met up with Brahma Sahampati, another mythical figure, who convinced the Buddha, as we now call him, as he has gained enlightenment, that there were people with but little dust on their eyes, as he put it. He created a vision of a pool of lotuses, and lotuses grow in the mud, and they start off deep, mired in the mud, but grow up through the mud, break through the surface, and are out into the sunlight. And he, Paramsahampati, said that human beings are like lotuses. Some of them are mired deep within the mud, but some of them are just ready to break through the surface, and with your help, perhaps they could. So the Buddha thought, let's give it a try. So his two meditation teachers that he'd gone with earlier in his early days had both died by this time. So he thought, I'll go and try and talk to my five former companions that had left me when I started eating. So we went to Sarnath, a deer park near what is now Varanasi, and he found the five. And the five at first were determined to ignore who they thought of as Siddhartha. But as he came close, they could see that something had changed, that there was something about him. And so despite themselves, they engaged in conversation with him. And it was at this point then that the Buddha began the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the very first teaching in modern times of the Dharma, of the Buddha's teaching. And so at this time he explained the fundamental principles of the Dharma, the middle way between extremes, the Four Noble Truths, how life contains a certain amount of suffering, that our suffering is due to craving and aversion, that if we can eliminate the craving and aversion, then we can eliminate the suffering, and that the way to eliminate the craving and aversion is the Noble Eightfold Path. So if we can practice the Noble Eightfold Path, then we can make progress. So we need to try to perfect our vision, perfect our emotional state, our speech, our actions, our livelihood, our effort, our awareness, and our meditative states. So the Buddha tried to explain all this to his five former followers. And this may have gone on for some time. These were all experienced people who knew a lot about talking about spiritual matters, spiritual debates and so on. So it may well have gone on for some time. But eventually the Buddha exclaimed, Kundana knows. Kundana knows. Kundana was one of the five. And at that point he had realized what the Buddha was trying to teach. He himself had made a breakthrough. And so at that point, Kundana had become the first of the Buddha's disciples. The Sangha had begun. And one by one, the five followers all made a breakthrough and understood what it was that the Buddha was trying to explain. And of course, over time, many, many more people, both monastic and wandering ascetics, and also householders, lay followers, took to following the Buddha and to try to follow his teachings. And the Buddha tried to encourage all the wandering ascetics, all the wandering followers that he had, to go out and spread the teaching further still, which during, when it wasn't the rainy season, is what they did. Spent their time wandering around, begging for alms, and explaining the teaching of the Dharma. And over the lifetime of the Buddha, over the next 50 years or so, the Buddha's teaching spread enormously to a great swathe of land over northern India and to a large number of people of all stations of life, including kings of those big kingdoms that I mentioned earlier. And the Buddha was able to talk with all sorts of people, from the lowliest people right up to royalty. And there are many adventures that he has, of course, during that period. And I'm sure we'll know a lot more about that in the coming weeks. But given the constraints of time, I need to move on those 50 years towards the end of the Buddha's life. And the Buddha is wandering as he tended to do. On this occasion, he's with his attendant, Ananda, or personal assistant, as I like to think of him, Ananda. And he realizes that he's approaching the end of his life. He's in his 80s by now. He has back trouble, and no doubt he has various other aches and pains and so on that one would expect at that age. They're invited to eat with Chunda, the blacksmith. And so they went there to eat, and they had a dish of pig's delight, it was called. And we don't know exactly what that was. It could, I suppose, been a dish of pork. It was the Buddha's practice that he would never eat meat that was made especially for him, but he would eat anything that was given to him. So if somebody gave him meat into his alms bowl, then he would eat it, but he didn't want meat cooked especially on his behalf. It could have been then that this was a dish of pork, this pig's delight, though not very delightful for the pig, obviously, but that's one option. So the other thing is, of course, pigs are very keen on mushrooms, aren't they? They use pigs for truffle hunting. So they like to sniff out mushrooms. Although, if I'm perfectly honest, my sister-in-law has got some pigs, and they don't like mushrooms. So that does undermine my story. But anyway, it could have been that, because it could have been a dish of mushrooms, and then there could have been a couple of toadstools that found their way into it. I don't know. We don't know, do we? We don't have recordings of the time. But anyway, as a result of eating this meal, the Buddha became very ill indeed. He was concerned that people would blame Chunda the blacksmith, so he made a point of saying, please don't, you know, he hasn't done anything wrong, it's just one of those things, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later, you know, I'm an old man, please don't hold him to blame. So they went on, Ananda and the Buddha, and came to the final resting place of Kusinagara. And there the Buddha lay down under a grove of trees. Word spread that the Buddha was approaching the end of his life, and so all of his followers that were able to, that were within range, came to be with the Buddha during this time. And so as they were gathering around, the Buddha said to them that when I'm gone, the Dharma will be your teacher. That is all you need. I've taught you everything that you need to know. As that's the case, do any of you have any questions, any queries, any doubts, any confusion that you want me to clear up? Because this is the last chance you'll get. And nobody said anything. So the Buddha, concerned that some people might be a bit embarrassed to ask, excuse me, Buddha, I'm not sure about this point. He said, look, if you do have something that you've got doubts about, get a friend to ask on your behalf. So again, are there any questions? So again, there was silence. So at this point, the Buddha encouraged people to carry on with the practice, to use the Dharma as their teaching, but also to rely on themselves. And his final words were, with mindfulness, strive on. And at that, the Buddha ended his physical life, relinquished his physical body, and had the final release of Parinirvana.